All right. Good to see you tonight. Let's see, I'm going to tell you tonight, this is what ladies are talking about when they're talking about, Brother Moss, you appreciate this. It's what ladies talk about when they talk about having a bad hair day. And when it rains, my hair gets curly, Judy. You like that? Anyway, I need a haircut.
I told him I'd fix him up.
Mama says not to get my hair cut short because it makes my jaws look fat. I said, Mama, I believe my jaws are fat. She said, they are, but they look worse with your hair short. All right, good to see y'all tonight. We appreciate your presence. Glad you're here for our Bible class. We invite you to take your Bibles with you. Open to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, part of what we refer to in the Bible as wisdom literature. God instructing us from the bottom up. He's allowing us through the books of Ecclesiastes, the Proverbs, some of the Psalms, Song of Solomon, and some of the literature written therein, the book of Job, to learn spiritual truths without him having to press down upon you from above and saying that this is the way it's going to be. He's invited us to look at the world that he created and made and learn from that. There's all kinds of ways to learn and be instructed by God even without a word from him. We cannot be fully ever instructed by God without his words, but we can learn a lot without his words. We can learn that there's a God without his word. The Apostle Paul, writing to the church at Rome, you remember, talked about how the invisible attributes of God are clearly seen. The invisible attributes of God are clearly seen, he says, by the things that he has made. So we know of God's power and majesty and greatness. We know a lot about his nature by the things that he's created. And so that created world also speaks to us. The stars, the sun, the moon, the psalmist said, speaks to us. Uttering knowledge throughout all the world and throughout all lands and peoples about God and his greatness. They ought to instruct us about those things. Ecclesiastes is part of that type of literature, inviting you to learn from the world around you. The writer of the book of Ecclesiastes, who I believe is Solomon, is instructing us from the things that he's learned in his walks of life. My belief is that Solomon wrote this when he's an old man. And I believe he wrote it as an old man who is penitent for the mistakes he's made in his life, for the decisions he made. And he's telling us, he just lays bare himself throughout this book about all the things that he tried. He doesn't sugarcoat or hide the ways he tried to find meaning for his life under the sun. And what he concludes about that is that those searches and those efforts he made did not accomplish what he thought they would accomplish in this life. His attitude is not a negative attitude about eternity. I want us to remember that. He does not address problems of eternity or eternal things. His issues are with life under the sun, so keep that in mind. So when he talks about the same thing happens to a man happens to a dog, he's not talking about in heaven. Or he talks about there's no difference between the righteous and the wicked. They both die and go to the grave. He's not talking about there's no eternal difference. He's talking about from the standpoint of looking at things purely from a human perspective. It is frustrating to go through this life and to see the inequities, the inequalities and the shortcomings of others and the shortcomings of what life has to do. You know, John Stuart Mill was a great literary writer from many years ago, and Stuart Mill talked about being a skeptic in God. He said, I want to believe in God, and he said, one of the great reasons why it's hard for me to believe in God, his answer was because of nature. He said, this is what God made. He made this natural world. Blackstone, William Blackstone, who is really the father of our law, the system of law among the English and also America, wrote extensively about, in his writings, about God and nature and nature's God. That there's a natural law that comes from nature's God. God is the giver of all laws. Basically, the standpoint that if you're part of a Western civilization world that has a system of law, it usually finds itself rooted in the writings of William Blackstone, who wrote about nature's God and the law that comes from nature's God. So people say there's natural law, yes, but it came from a God who made the nature. So the nature sets about a law of things, and so that's God's example of God's authority over man, and then we take it and we try to adapt it to fit our needs, and so we use God's law from nature to establish law for ourselves. And so we have laws that forbid stealing and punish thieves because God did. And so that's kind of the idea of Blackstone head. We derive our principles of justice and those things from nature's God. But here's what John Stuart Mill said. He said, for almost all the things for which men are tried and hanged are nature's everyday activities. And the example he gave is that a violent storm comes, embarks upon a small town, levels schools and kindergartens and hospitals, and bypasses prisons and houses of ill repute. Nature's God, he said, created a world in which a tornado would tear down a school or a hospital and spare a prison or a place where evil is going on, like a nightclub or something like that. He said, now, how is it that we believe in a God who made that? That's some of the frustration the Ecclesiastes writer feels. And if you try to work it out in your mind that life here under the sun makes perfectly sense to you, then you'll feel the same frustration. And that's what the book is designed to do, to help us understand that we're not alone in our feelings about what's going on down here, and how that there's no difference between the rich and the poor, and there's no difference between the wise and the fool. They both die and go to the same place. So what advantage was it to be wise? And what advantage is a man if he lives 100 years, but he never has any life or any children? And then there's another man who lives, and he has wife and children, but he lives a short time and is cut down. What advantage is it? And so I want you to know he doesn't take aim at eternal things, things that belong to God. He's talking about that we live in this world that's a fallen world because of our sin, and it's going to be difficult and challenging to live in. But I want you also to note that in this his writings, in his effort here, that you see always there's a glimmer of hope in his words, a glimmer of hope in his writing, and he concludes it that way. That in this life you're living, you can't make sense of, and you don't know why things happen the way they do, and why Lot and life chooses you to be in its bullseye at times, while others seem to be getting off scot-free. He says, well, the conclusion of the whole matter is this: fear God, keep his commandments. That's the whole duty of man. You get that right, and you accomplish what God put you under the sun to accomplish. Fear God and keep his commandments. And so I think he's writing from the standpoint of a man who tried all those things, didn't find what he thought he would find, and he ends up where he began. That the only thing that really matters is your relationship to God. I want to pick up we here in chapter 1 in verse 12. The first few verses he introduced himself as the preacher, and a preacher where he introduced this message: vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And there's three things he said that drives him crazy that he thinks about. One, nothing ever changes. Nothing ever changes, no matter how long you live or what goes on. One generation comes, one generation passes away, nothing ever changes. No one can stop that process. No one's ever been able to thwart that process. With all modern technology and advancements in medicine, one generation passes away and another generation comes. The sun rises, the sun goes down. Every day you got these unending cycles. Nothing ever changes. All the water runs into the sea and the sea is not full. Nothing ever changes. The second thing he said that drives him crazy is that nothing ever seems to satisfy. He said, you work yourself to death. Verse 8, he said, all things are full of labor. But the eye is not satisfied with seeing. The ear is not satisfied and filled with hearing. We always want more. And that's why we don't know, I suppose, is anybody in their house and home, anybody have a black and white TV that you watch every night? We've moved on from that. We've got better things because the eye is not satisfied with seeing. When we first saw the color TV set, we didn't want to go back to the black and white. And the ear is not filled with hearing. We're not, as I said, listening to the 8-track tapes anymore. We've got better stuff than that. So nothing ever satisfies. And he says nothing, there's really nothing new. You live through life and you think, well, this is new. Well, every generation has new things and every generation has inventions. But there's nothing that's going on in your life that didn't go on in other people's life. They had a different time and a different place, but they went through the same process. They lived, they died, they grew, they learned, and at the end didn't accomplish anything, so all is vanity. Then in verse 12, he takes aim at what seems to be his wheelhouse, and that is wisdom. Now, there's something that really we can find some profit in. But look at what he says about it beginning in verse 12. I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works which are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity in the grasping for wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. Let's stop there just for a moment. So So here, this writer, this gentleman who I believe is Solomon, who was king over Israel in Jerusalem, he said he set out his heart to seek and search out by wisdom all the things that was going on in this world, all the things that was happening in this life. He wanted to find out what was going on and why he was here, why these things were happening, all that is done under the sun. He says about this, it's a task given by God to all men. And what he's talking about is there's a universal nature in all men. To know more, to wonder and find out, why are we here? What is the purpose of my life? What am I trying to do? Why did God give me this life? What am I supposed to be doing with it? It kind of gets to you at times trying to figure out what we're doing, why we're here, what we're supposed to be doing. There's never been probably a people on this earth, or a generation of people on this earth, or a tribe of people on this earth that have not had some challenge of this concept. And whether they believe in God or not, or their God or not, they've wondered, why are we here? Yes, sir. All right, and it does. It's a burden to ask that they may be exercised, and that's what to keep them occupied. They work at it all the time, he says. I work at it all the time. And he says, in all that effort that men go through, that I went through, that I set my heart to seek and search out wisdom, just verse 14, to look at all the works done under the sun, and he said, I've concluded this, that doing that job of trying to figure out what it is that's going on here in life under the sun, he said, it's vanity, it's the grasping for wind. What's another way of saying grasping for wind? What's another thought of that, or you have? What does that mean? Let me say it that way. Futile. You can't lay hold on. So there's just so much about life you're never going to know the answer to. You'll drive yourself crazy trying to figure out some things, why this is and why that ain't, why you're here, why you were born, when you were, where you were, and who you are. You run yourself crazy trying to answer the questions that you don't have any answers to. And he says, what I concluded is that it's all vanity. In fact, he said, what I've concluded is what he concluded in verse 15. What is crooked cannot be made straight. What is lacking cannot be numbered. What does he mean by that?
I've heard that before. The New Testament, I think it was John the Baptist. Was that?
Well, you're thinking about where John's job was to make straight the paths of the Lord, to prepare the way for the Lord. It's close, but it's not the same. Well, yeah, you're not going to solve these things. You're not going to fix it. You're not going to solve it. You're not going to change it. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Flip over there. Hold your place. Flip over there. When he talks about that which is made crooked cannot be made straight, when he talks about that which is lacking cannot be numbered, whose work is he talking about? Who made it crooked? Let's read. It's a setup question. And so I want to show you how wrong you are. Look at chapter 7. No, that's right. I know it. That's why I didn't want you to leave one picking. Look at Ecclesiastes chapter 7, verse 13. Consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he's made crooked? Now, that is the context of what he's talking about here in verse 15. What's frustrating is, he said, God set things up this way. He gave you this job. He gave you this task. He gave you intelligence and knowledge and wisdom. And you can't fix it, you can't straighten it out, you can't change anything. And we're going to solve the world's problems. You know, that's like I was having this great debate with one of my son's friends about climate change. And is the climate changing? I suppose I don't have a clue. But if it is, I don't know what we're going to do about it. And what I would suggest this, probably what we're going to find out in 100 years is the things we did to fix it probably made it worse or made something worse. They're trying to keep the world from getting too hot. You know how many people die every year because they don't have enough heat? I'm serious. You look up the stats of the number one cause of death in the world because of natural occurrences, and lack of heat is right up there with everything else. Well, if the world was warmer, wouldn't that help that some? You know, we might have to move a little. You know, we might have to move a mile or two away from the cow ford if the water gets high. But anyway, I don't know that we know the answer to any of those things. But we're going to try. We're going to work ourselves to death. We're going to figure this out. And we're going to save this planet that God made in 6 days. We're going to save it. And yeah. That's a good question. And there's two kinds of wisdom Solomon talks about in this context. Let's read a little further. We'll come back to that question. Two kinds of wisdom. There's wisdom that comes from God. The book of James talks about that, doesn't it? There's two kinds of wisdom. There's a wisdom that comes from God that is spiritual and heavenly and eternal. And there's a wisdom that comes from this world, and James said, which is demonic, fleshly. And so he talks about, he compares that there are two ways, two types of wisdom at work here. Look at what he says here in verse 16. I communed with my heart, saying, look, I have attained greatness. I have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge. I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. And I perceive that this is also grace for you. Now, think about this. In verse 16, he says that I have attained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem, and my heart understood great wisdom and knowledge. And in verse 17, then, he says, I set my heart to know wisdom. So why would he set his heart to know wisdom if he'd already attained it and gained it and had more than anybody ever had? Well, verse 16 and 17 is talking about two different kinds of wisdom. That's right. He got wisdom that came from God, and it was great. It's greater than anybody's, anybody that ever before him. But he also decided that he's going to figure things out for himself, too. He's going to put human wisdom to work here and even dig deeper than God had revealed to him. He's going to find out more than God said about it. That's pride. That's exactly what it is. All right. So he said, I set my heart to know this. And in verse 17, he said, I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this is also grasping for wind. Now, we're in a section here where he's talking about, I'm frustrated. And he said, one of the things that drives me crazy, the three things that drives me crazy is nothing seems to ever change, no matter what. Nothing ever seems to satisfy us, no matter what. And there ain't really nothing new going on under the sun. The same things happen to all generations as they come along. And he says, but what I thought is because of my wisdom, I put wisdom to work. And I would find, in putting my wisdom to work, really some answers. And he said, I didn't find any answers. My wisdom couldn't make what God made crooked straight. Okay, that's right. The wisdom of man is foolishness to God. That's right. 1 Corinthians chapter 1, Paul said. So he says here, so I set my heart to know three things. He says, to know wisdom, to know madness and folly. Now, this wisdom here, as I said, I believe he's talking about human wisdom, philosophy, man's ideas and understandings, how brilliant we are ourselves, how brilliant we can be. You remember, it's kind of when, ain't none of my, Randy and them's not here now, so I was thinking about when, Randy would always talk about when Goober growed the beard on the show, and everybody told him he looked smart, so he started talking, using a different language and talking real smart, you know, about things he didn't know nothing about. That's what we do. And so it's because somebody told him you look real smart with that beard. So all of a sudden he decided he was smart. Nothing changed from one day to that to the next. All right. He said, so I set my heart to know wisdom. And then he said to know madness. Well, why would somebody want to know madness? What is that? Words mean something, but they don't necessarily mean what you think. Now I use this word today. And we mean something maybe totally different from it. When someone, we say, that guy's going crazy. We're going to work it out. We're going to work it out. To know madness. Why would he want to know madness? You know, when I think about madness, we think about somebody that's going out of their mind, somebody that's going crazy, somebody that's out of control. Why would he want to say, I'm going to seek out and search madness? That would be something that we need to get hold of. What is he talking about here? What is it, though? What is madness? No, that's repetition. What is madness? Now, you're going to have to figure out what these words mean, right? What does it mean? Huh? What does it say, brother? What does it say? Of mirth, what does it accomplish? Look at verse 12 of chapter 2. I turn myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. Now, I want you to notice when he uses those together, he's drawing a contrast between those three ideas. He's not saying they're all the same. Wisdom is not the same as madness, and madness is not the same as folly. And what he's saying is that I tried, there's kind of three approaches to life here. I'm going to philosophize through life and really get to the deep understanding of the meanings of life. And Vance, I apologize. I should let you talk about that Goober thing. You remember when he grew the beard and got smart? Anyway, but and so you become brilliant in your own understanding in your mind, and you're gonna figure everything out. And then there's some people who don't care about that part of life. They care about other things in life. The word madness here is really means to live an extravagant life. It's not a real good interpretation of the Hebrew word, to be honest with you. Although we use language like that all the time. You know what my dad used to say about people? He said this about my brother sometimes. He didn't say about me because I never had the money they had. But Keith, my oldest brother, you know, he lived at home until he was like 50. No, he's about 30. He's about 29. I think he's 29 when he got married. So he lived at home the whole time. And he piled up his money. You know, he worked hard and made good money, and he piled it up. And he traded. He bought new vehicles about once a year. He'd go trade. And he'd always have this same story. Daddy said, "You crazy, man. What are you doing, son? Why are you doing trading vehicles every year?" And he'd say, "Daddy, I couldn't afford not to." Daddy didn't ever buy that, you know. I couldn't afford not to. But my daddy would say, I'd say, "Keith, buy a new truck." He just bought a new truck. He said, "Yeah, he bought it." I said, "Why did he do that?" "Because he's got more money than he's got." He's crazy, ain't he? Well, he's living an extravagant lifestyle. And we say that about people. Look at what they're building. Look at the money they spend on that. These people's crazy. It's that kind of idea. You know what? You think of a New Testament passage where someone said to a fellow, "Much learning hath made thee." Well, what was Festus saying to Paul when he said that? That he was literally out of his mind and crazy? You think? No, that's right, because Agrippa said, "Man, you almost persuade me." So he wasn't talking out of his head. He wasn't talking crazy. So why did Festus say, "You're mad in what you're saying"? Why would he say that? Well, because the choices Paul made didn't make sense to Festus. Paul just got through telling him how, "I'm here today because Jesus appeared to me on the road to Damascus, and I've given my life to him, and I'm going to serve him, and that's why the Jews hate me, and that's why they're trying to kill me, and that's why I make my appeal to Caesar." And here's what Festus is thinking. Why would a man sign his own death warrant by going to Caesar for something about a man named Jesus? Why would you do that? So he's not saying you're crazy in the sense that you're literally out of your mind and you've gone wild and can't nobody make any sense of what you're saying. He's just you've chosen a path of life for yourself. He's saying that doesn't make any sense for me. But in the context of Ecclesiastes, that word means the idea of living in it. So he says, forget learning, man. Forget school. Forget philosophy. Let's just live it up a while. Let's get all that we can get. So I tried that. And then the third thing he tried was folly. I set my heart to know wisdom, madness, and folly. So what is folly? Does anybody have a different use a different word than folly? You know what's amazing to me? Let me tell you why you know that this verse is hard to understand is because I looked at about 50 different translations, and almost every one of them said wisdom, madness, and folly. Because they have a hard time figuring out, I don't know what other word to put there. So what is folly? Rick said, you know, kind of person doing stupid stuff. Well, you think that's what Solomon was saying? I'm going to try stupid stuff. He didn't think it was stupid, did he? I mean, looking back, you ever tried any stupid stuff to Rick? It wasn't stupid at the time, was it? But looking back, it's stupid stuff. All right? So what is folly here? He's going to try it. He's going to devote his life to kind of figuring out what that's about. Well, and no offense, women. So anyway, the idea of folly is just kind of foolishness. Now, it's not necessarily foolishness to you in the moment, but it kind of looks like foolishness to everybody else. So what he's talking about is, I'm going to have a good time. It's not living in luxury necessarily. Maybe it's gambling your money away. Maybe it's drinking. Maybe it's women. I'm going to live it up a while. So I'm going to try all this stuff. Yeah. Huh? That's what he decided he's going to do. Look at verse 18. So here's what I conclude. For in much wisdom is much grief, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. Now, we caution people the right opposite all the time. You got to learn. You got to get your education. You got to get smart. You got to know more. If you don't, your life's going to be too hard on you. But you know, some of the most unhappiest, miserable people I know are people who have everything figured out. They figure everything out. I mentioned earlier, I was talking about climate change. I said I was doing these debates with my son, friends he brought home from college, and they were talking about that stuff, and they're just driving themselves crazy about it. Worried, wringing their hands, you know, we're destroying this planet. Look, your girl told me we had about 7 to 10 years to save it. I said, well, they said that 25 years ago. And she said, well, we got to do something about it. I said, well, won't y'all start with y'all's bedroom? Go in there and look at his bedroom. When you figure out how to fix that bedroom, we'll start on the oceans. Yes, sir. Thank you, Brother Dunaway. You said suppose. Okay. Go ahead. I sure would. I think I made this statement, maybe I made it Sunday in my Bible, maybe on Wednesday night, but where my daddy used to say that, he said, if I thought God heard and answered every prayer I ever prayed the way I wanted it, I'd quit praying. You know, you understand the principle. That's what you're talking about. If I had it all figured out, I'd probably be miserable too. But the point is that didn't satisfy his longing. It didn't accomplish what he wanted it to accomplish. And chances are that all of us are sitting here today thinking about how we believe certain things today that we didn't believe 30 years ago, just about life, you know, what's important, what ain't important, what's useful and what's not useful, how our time should be spent and how it shouldn't be spent. Sometimes we learn those lessons too late. Any other questions or comments? All right, so he's ready to put all this to work. I'm going to learn all I can learn. I'm going to do all I can do. And I'm going to dance and have a good time doing it. If he, from Cross River, he'd been at Salem Skating Ring on Friday night, this fellow right here in the next chapter, Mike. All right, look at chapter 2. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely, this is also vanity. I said of laughter, madness, of mirth. What does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life. Let's stop there. So he says here, he announces here at the beginning of chapter 2 what he's found. And you know what he's found is that these exercises he engaged in to know wisdom, to know madness, and know folly, it didn't help him. It didn't solve anything. It still, he announces that in chapter 1, in verse 1 of chapter 2, this was also vanity. He asked the question in verse 2, what did it accomplish? When I sought to gratify my flesh with wine, guiding my heart with wisdom, lay hold on folly, till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their life. So how did he go about that? Look at verse 4. I made my works great. I built myself houses. I planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards. I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold, and special treasures of kings and of provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kinds. So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem, and also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. This was also the reward of my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done, on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and the grasping for wind. There was no profit under the sun. I was talking to a young lady the other day. She said, Mr. Casey, she said, I need some help. And I said, well, you know, I'll try to help you. She said, I need a car. She said, can you help me get a car? She said, I don't have enough money to get a car. And she said, can you help me get a car? And I said, yeah, I'll probably help you get a car. And I said, but who's going to help you put gas in? Well, I'll have to figure out. I said, who's going to help you pay the insurance on? Who's going to help you buy tires for? Who's going to help you And I know I ain't having to buy a tire. Tell me that, you know, tire's too high. I said, you know, you get a car, and that comes, when you get one, it comes with 1,000 other expenses. And so I think about that when I read all these things that he's building here. And every new palace he built, that comes with a yard to cut, bushes to trim, moats to keep water clean, you know, whatever that, every how they built it, came with its own set of problems. I'm going to build this thing, and it's going to be wonderful. Oh, it's going to be wonderful. You know, probably the happiest time, one of the happiest times in my life, me and Kimberly was living in a little old trailer down on the river, down here by the nuclear plant. And I'd get home from work every evening and walk down there at the boat ramp and listen to the water lap against the shore and fish or whatever I wanted to do for a little while. It's an easy life. And then we lived down there for a few months while we were building the house we're in now, which is not anything necessarily special, but it was special to compare to what we'd been in. And now looking back, you know, 30 years later, I remember I told Kimberly not long ago, I said, you know, if we'd have stayed in that little trailer down there, I said, you think about the money I'd have. She said, you wouldn't have no money. I said, how you figure? She said, because I'd have left you and took all of it. She said, I wasn't going to stay in that trailer the rest of my life down there next door to my family. But anyway, you want something better and bigger, and it all comes with its own set of problems. He said, I just decided I'm going to get everything bigger and better. I went to work, man. I went to work to build these things. Now, there is some contradiction in things sometimes. You know, we talked about, well, I read you those Proverbs a couple of weeks ago where it talked about how you ought to be busy as an ant doing stuff, busy working. If you don't build and take care of your stuff, it falls to pieces. And that's just true. But if you think that you're going to find your purpose in life, the fact that you stacked up more bricks than the guy beside you, that ain't going to. I find you're gonna find, looking back, probably that you were happier with less, and when you didn't have this or didn't have that, and that's what he's figuring out here. I set my heart and went to work and worked more than anybody around me. Hold your place here. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 7. Again, one of the reasons why I'm so convinced it's Solomon is because of the language used here in many, many places is almost identical to some of the language used in 1 Kings about Solomon, and certainly some of the stories here. But, yes, sir. Somebody say Casey. All right, 1 Kings chapter 7. Look at what he says beginning in verse 1. He says, but Solomon took 13 years to build his own house. Big house, 13 years. So he finished all his house. He also built the house of the forest of Lebanon. Its length was 100 cubits. Its height, 30 cubits, four rows of cedar pillars and cedar beams on the pillars. And it was paneled with cedar above the beams that were 45 pillars, 15 to a row. Now, I don't hardly know what none of that means, but I bet you David Griffin could tell you that they're doing some building there with all these pillars, right? There were windows. That's something Brother Griffin knows something about, too. There were windows with beveled frames in three rows, and window was opposite window in three tiers. All the doorways and doorposts had rectangular frames. The window was opposite window in three tiers. He also made the hall of pillars. Its length was 50 cubits. Its width 30 cubits. And in front of them was a portico with pillars, and a canopy was in front of them. Then he made the hall for the throne, the hall of judgment, where he might judge. It was paneled with cedar from floor to ceiling. And the house where he dwelled had the court inside the hall of light workmanship. Solomon also made a house like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken in. See, he ain't just building houses for himself. He built his house. He built vacation houses. He built houses to judge in. He built houses for women that he fell in love with, right? Look at verse 9. All these were costly. All these were of costly stones, cut to size, trimmed with saws, inside and out. From the foundation of the eaves also to the outside of the great court, the foundation was of costly stones, large stones, some 10 cubits, some 8 cubits. And above were costly stones, hewn to size, cedar wood. The great court was enclosed with three rows of hewn stones and a row of cedar beams. So were the inner court of the house of the Lord and the vestibule of the temple. Now, that's one little old small example of some of the building that he had going on. And you continue to read over into chapters 9 and chapter 12, Father, about all the things that he got busy building and doing for himself. And he found that all these things he did, the fact that he didn't keep anything from his eyes that he desired, he didn't withhold anything from his heart of any pleasure. And he said, I was, rejoicing in all my labor, and this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked, the works of my hands had done, and also this was vanity, the grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun. And again, the key phrase there is under the sun. He got all that built. Now he's got to keep it up. And so what did that accomplish for me, really? What did it accomplish? It didn't really accomplish anything. He can't live in but one of those houses. And in fact, he can't be in but one room in one of those houses at one time. And so it was not something that accomplished anything. As he says here in verse 10, whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them, and that didn't do it for me. That's the same thing he said back in chapter 1, where he said, the eye is not satisfied with seeing. So whatever my eye saw, that's what I figured out how to get for myself, and that didn't do it for me. It did not accomplish the goals that I thought that it would accomplish. I thought I was happy. I seemed to be happy during when all this work was going on. Man, I'm doing something. I'm doing something great here. I'm building all these things, and I get done with it, and I think, well, what's next? What am I going to do next? And that's what he says in the next verse. Look at verse 12. Then I turned myself to consider wisdom, madness, and folly. Searching for the deep truths of life, living this extravagant life, and sometimes getting drunk and partying. Got it all, right? Smart, extravagant life, living it up. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? It's a question. What do you think he means by that question? What can the man do that succeeds the king? What do you think he's saying? Who's going to be Alabama's next coach? Next football coach?
Jim Harbaugh.
I don't know who it's going to be. He went to Michigan. Yeah, how'd you like to have that job, right? How'd you like to have that job? How'd you like to follow that, right? And that's going to be a tough task to follow. You know what he's saying here? I'd hate to be the guy that comes after me, man. I'd hate to be the guy that has to keep up with the way I set things up here. Oh, he's going to be. So he's rhetorically asking this question. What's the next guy going to do who succeeds the king? And he answers himself with desperation. Look at what he says. Only what he has already done. He's going to do the same thing I've done. He's going to have his own project. Yes, sir. Yep. That's right. Yep. Might be. What's going to happen if this guy comes along? He's going to do the same thing. He's going to seek after power, whatever form it comes. What did God warn the children of Israel kings would do? If they selected kings for themselves, if you appoint kings for yourself, what's he going to do? He's going to take your children. He's going to make them his servants. He's going to put them to work for himself. He's going to put an army together for himself. John? Yep. It could be. But you know, when David built his house, the Lord's temple was a tent. And remember what David said? Shall I live in paneled houses while the ark of our Lord dwelleth in tents? I shall build the Lord a house. And the Lord said to him, when have I ever said anything to you about building me a house? All right, we'll stop there. It's good. It ain't hard to quit, ain't it, brother? I hear you.